I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, the Edgewood Independent School District Board voted in favor of sanctioning its youngest trustee, Michael Valdez, during a special meeting Monday night. Valdez's crime was talking to the media without authorization. Valdez joins us to discuss his free speech rights and the need for transparency. And later on The Source, Hannah Arendt came of age in Germany as Hitler rose to power before escaping to the U.S. as a Jewish refugee. Arendt's time as a political prisoner, refugee, and survivor in Europe informed her groundbreaking insights into the human condition, the refugee crisis, and totalitarianism. PBS's documentary, Hannah Arendt Facing Tyranny, takes a closer look at one of the most fearless political writers of modern times. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Are you ready to amplify your impact through workplace giving? Many employers match donations, doubling or even tripling your support for TPR's local and global programming. Some employers even match gifts from retirees and spouses, so your contribution can go even further. Check if your company participates today by visiting tpr.org/workplacegiving.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about the political philosopher Hannah Arendt, about the rise of totalitarianism. But first, Michael Valdez was elected to the Edgewood Independent School District Board in November of 2022, shortly after graduating from Edgewood Fine Arts Academy. At the time of his election, he was 19 years old, making him the youngest trustee in Bexar County. On Monday, during a special board meeting, Valdez was sanctioned by his fellow board members, stripped of his committee assignments, barred from holding, becoming an officer position for the 2025-26 school year, and he will not be allowed to attend a professional trip with the board scheduled for later this year. This was because Valdez spoke to the news media without authorization from the board president. Michael Valdez joins us to discuss the situation. Michael, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first off, we need to really make it clear that you are here as a private citizen exercising your free speech. You are not here representing Edgewood ISD. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, why is it important that we make that clarification?
It's important that we make that clarification because that's what the censor, that was in the censor for the school board, that I did not make it more clear.
All right, so there was an incident at a board meeting. An individual, they spoke too long and the citizens to be heard portion of the event. That person was removed from the premises and they were arrested and they were booked. There are a lot of questions about that incident. You spoke to the news media about that to provide some clarification, and you did that as a private citizen?
Correct.
Okay, but that apparently got under the skin of the superintendent and the board president.
Yes.
Okay, so then they say, well, okay, Michael, we can't have that. We can't have you talking to the media, even though you are a board member, you were there, you saw what happened, and you are a private citizen and a resident and a taxpayer of Edgewood ISD. What did they do to you? What happened?
So I did not know what the censor was going to be. All I just knew is that there was going to be a special called board meeting. I did not have any idea. I knew it was about me, but I didn't know in what context until the board came out of closed session and said that it was because I was speaking to the media.
Okay, so here you are today in the studio at Texas Public Radio. I hate to break it to you, this is the media as well. So evidently, you are unbowed. This is not going to impact you on talking to the media?
I could talk to the media as long as I'm not speaking on behalf of the Edgewood School Board.
Okay. there were also, when the board voted, and it was 6-1, and you were the one vote, everyone voted to censor you that day, right?
Yes, and they tried to tell me that I couldn't vote, but the law is I can vote.
All right, so they said, okay. And you had to fight, or did you have to present an argument telling them that you were allowed to vote?
Yes, I did ask the attorney. We did ask the attorney, and the attorney said, yes, I can vote.
Okay. And they were telling you during that time that you have a history of unprofessional conduct on the school board, and you have been censored in the past as well. I have to tell you, just being in the studio with you right now, you seem pretty chill. Like, you're not like somebody who is bombastic and would be, I would assume, to be do a lot of unprofessional. What were their complaints?
The complaints, I believe it came from employees and just the way they said that my conduct is, how it's not aligned in the board operating procedures.
And were those board operating procedures made clear? Did they spell that out for you? It's like you were slouching. What were they saying?
It's just the way that they say that I present myself in the boardroom as well. They say I'm presenting myself in a hostile environment, but also those board operating procedures. When I got on the board, they weren't touched in like a few years. But then when I got on the board, that's when the board started amending those procedures to be more in the board's favor.
So you ran not long after you graduated from Edgewood Fine Arts Academy and you were elected. What do you think that you that gives you kind of an outsider status on among the board members, that they find your presence there a threat or something, that they don't want you there? Are you feeling that this is not just about your, I hate to call it unprofessional behavior because I don't think that's correct, but you know, they and also talking to the media, don't other board members ever talk to the media? Is only the are you the only one who ever does that?
I believe I'm the only one that does speak, especially in opposition of things that are happening, which I have every right to, serving on the school board.
All right, so they may not like a dissent to be able to be vocalized in the media to what policies or procedures or what's happening with the budget at Edgewood ISD. They want to have a unified voice.
Yes.
Okay. Are you going to be running for re-election?
Yes, I will be running again.
And that will be in November of 2026?
Yes.
All right. And so what are you hearing from your supporters who tell you? Have you heard from people saying, Michael, get your act together. How dare you act that way? Or are they telling you, we appreciate you. We want the transparency. We do want you to continue talking to us and telling us what is happening on the board?
A lot of my supporters are really appreciative. I do ask a lot of questions at the board workshop, at the board meeting, just because I'm really involved in the district, in the board, in how transparent and accountable I am to the district.
So talking to us, did you get permission from the board president today to come on Texas Public Radio, or are you going rogue again, Michael?
Well, I haven't asked the school district just because I'm not speaking on behalf of the school board.
Okay, so and what else could they do to you? They already sanctioned you this one time. They've taken away your ability to be an officer. You can't go on the trip. It's like you can't go on the field trip, Michael. You know, what else could they sanction you even further?
The only thing that I'm aware of is what they said in the last resolution is that they can bar me from all the district properties except during the board meeting times.
Okay. Are you a threat to public safety? Would you, I mean, how can they ban you from public spaces even though, you know, you are a board member and you are a citizen of Edgewood ISD and you have never been charged with doing anything that's a threat to public safety?
Well, I'm not a threat. I'm just serving on the school board.
All right, and you plan to continue serving, representing the voters of Edgewood ISD, talking to them, keeping them informed? Transparency is important to you?
Yes.
All right. Well, Michael Valdez, he was sanctioned by the Edgewood ISD board. He is a member of the board, and they sanctioned him for speaking to the media without authorization. And Michael, thank you so much for coming in today and talking to us about that. And when we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about a voice of dissent, a voice warning us about tyranny and totalitarianism, Hannah Arendt. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. They are committed to helping policyholders build strong and thriving businesses through their exceptional service. More at texasmutual.com/texansdeliver. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Frequently today, many of us are looking at what's happening across America, and there is a lot of head scratching going on. We have secret police snatching people off the street. Universities' journalism is under attack. There is the weakening of the judicial branch, extreme gerrymandering. All of this and more makes us wonder, are we seeing some form of tyranny or totalitarianism taking over the nation? Well, it helps to have an understanding of what that has looked like in the past. What have other nations experienced when they became totalitarian regimes? And so we turn to writers of that era who witnessed it and warned that this could happen again, even here in the United States. And one of those writers would be Hannah Arendt. She was one of the most fearless political thinkers of the 20th century. A recent PBS American Masters documentary, Hannah Arendt, Facing Tyranny, tells her compelling story. It explores how Arendt experienced as a political prisoner in Nazi Germany. She was a stateless refugee and later a keen observer of American democracy. All this shaped her insights into totalitarianism, civil rights, political truth, and the right to dissent. We're joined by the co-director and executive producer of the film, Jeff Beaver. And Jeff, welcome to The Source.
Hey, David. Good to be with you.
Jeff, I get the sense that this is a passion project for you. Is that right?
Well, you know, passion meaning that I've been working on this. I was working on this film for about 5 years. Anything I've done, most of the projects I've done in public media, I've produced a lot of documentaries. You do it because you believe in the issue you're covering. You believe in, you know, what you want people to hear. This is definitely a work of passion and something I really want to get out to the public.
Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, if you want to join the conversation, talk about Hannah Arendt, and also about the threat of totalitarianism, how this works, which is really interesting. It works in a certain kind of way, and we get that from her writing, 833-TPR-TALK. So Hannah Arendt, her story is compelling. And she seemed to be the right person at the right time, witnessed a lot of horrors in order to really capture what was happening. Can you talk a little bit about her background?
Yeah, sure. So Hannah Arendt is born in Germany in 1906 to a middle-class Jewish family. She's brilliant, rambunctious, just funny, beautiful woman. Goes to university in 1924. The same year that Adolf Hitler writes Mein Kampf. He writes it in 1923 when he's sent to prison.
100 years ago. Celebrating the centennial of it, but we're marking it, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And so she starts to study philosophy. And what she says in terms of philosophy is she starts to study how to think. And she says that all thinking, all understanding of our world comes from one's experience. And she gets a doctorate degree in philosophy and moves to Berlin in 1929. Gets married to a nice Jewish guy in September 29. 1 month later, the stock market crashes. And all hell breaks loose all over the world, including Germany. At the same time, you have a guy named Adolf Hitler, World War I veteran, who in 1919 tried to overthrow the government. He's arrested. He gets out. And he adds this extreme right-wing party that turns into the Nazi Party. And she's there in 1929 observing all of this. And she's warning her friends that this guy is for real, that we need to take him seriously. And most of her friends were saying, you know, nothing's going to happen. We're going to be fine. And in essence, what happens with her is in 1933, the Reichstag burns, meaning the German parliament. And Hitler blames the communists for doing so and declares martial law. She then joins the resistance to try to expose the anti-Semitic propaganda that Hitler and the Nazis are, you know, pushing out there to the rest of the world. And she gets arrested by the Gestapo. She gets out. She escapes to France. And then she starts to help Jewish kids get out to what was then Palestine. And she gets interned with all German citizens after Germany attacks France. And she gets interned and escapes again comes to the United States in the spring of 1941. In 43, she and everybody else learns about the death camps, Auschwitz and other places where, you know, Hitler and the Nazis declared war on the Jews, basically. And she starts to ask the question, how did this happen? What happened? Why did this happen? And she starts to write a book called Origins of Totalitarianism, where she asks those questions. And what she finds is really surprising. She basically finds that people, good people, ordinary people, school teachers, accountants, police officers, university professors, were all sucked in to this totalitarian system. Why? Because after World War I, Germany loses the war, 1918. And the Allies make them pay reparations. They make them demilitarize. Germany experiences hyperinflation. People are out of work. People are really depressed. And then when the economy crashes in 1929, people are looking for work. And there's a huge refugee crisis of people pouring into Germany looking for jobs. And Hitler comes on the scene and he basically says, I'm going to bring jobs back to Germany again. I'm going to make Germany great again. I'm going to rebuild the military. And he starts blaming the immigrants for taking jobs away, and specifically starts blaming the Jews. And so she sees this, but it's only in 1943 to 49 when she's writing this book, she begins to realize what exactly happened. And what she says is that after World War I, people were experiencing loneliness, meaning existential loneliness. You know, they were feeling disconnected to their way of life. And they were longing for meaning in their life. And Hitler comes on the scene and says, I'm gonna give you meaning again. And they subscribe to him, even though they know the guy is lying. But they still subscribe to this totalitarian system. And what she says is everybody was sucked into this system. And, you know, it creates World War II, it creates the Holocaust. And so in a nutshell, after that book is published, you know, she gets notoriety, she gets teaching positions. And then McCarthyism comes on the scene, and she begins to see what's happening in America. But I'm going to stop there. Mm-hmm. I'm just let you digest what I just said.
Yeah. So we have to just make the clarification that as we talk about, you know, people can't help but see some of the similarities between what happened in Germany in the 1920s and 30s and say, well, we're having some issues here in the United States, attacks on the media, attacks on the judicial branch, attacks on, you know, universities. But, you know, it just not everything. And it always hurts to try to compare things to the Nazis because they were so extreme in what they did and the Holocaust. But not all accusations of like we're becoming a tyranny, a totalitarianism means we're becoming Nazi Germany. But it doesn't mean. But it does mean we are becoming totalitarianism. Nazi Germany was something completely separate and apart. It doesn't mean that we're going to start, you know, death camps in the United States. But it does mean are we going to have a loss of freedom and certain things that make America America? That's the thing I'm concerned about.
Well, first off, I didn't do this film to compare it to the United States. I did the film to show what happened in history. I never show the present day in this film, I keep within history itself. What she says is that there's always been authoritarians in this world. She makes a big distinction between authoritarians, dictators, and a totalitarian state. So she writes that authoritarians want to take over the public sphere, meaning they want to control civil society, cultural centers, universities, governments, the courts, the public infrastructure, right? But then what she says, in a totalitarian state, they want to take over the private sphere. They want to take over how you think. So there's a big difference. I think we need to be very, very careful. I honestly don't think we're in a totalitarian state at all here. But certainly there's a lot of pressures that the federal government is pushing against constitutional norms. They're pushing against things, you know, that we never saw before. Now, the big difference between what's happening here now and what happened then is we still have three branches of government, right? There's the Congress, judicial branch, and the executive branch. Now, some might say that part of the Congress is a bit rolled over to whatever the executive branch wants, but we still have the courts, and we have to pay attention to that. And there's tons of lawsuits out there in which the executive branch is adhering to. So I think we need to be very careful.
We're definitely we're still the United States, which has three branches of the government. We have all these checks and balances, but we do have these warning signs that it does seem like Hannah Arendt had clocked during her time.
Well, that's exactly right. Look, when she comes to the United States in 1950, McCarthyism comes on the scene. And McCarthyism starts to point his fingers at people in the State Department, in government, in Hollywood, accusing people of being communists. And basically, people are being put on the stand in the government and basically saying, you know, if you're a communist, they're kind of canceled, if you will. And she was afraid that people would lose their citizenship. She was afraid that people wouldn't have due process. And then she covers the Pentagon Papers, and it comes out in June of 71, in which the government was lying about the Vietnam War. But what really scares her is when Watergate breaks, right? And Nixon, you know, commits real crimes. And what she says then in an interview she gives in 1973, she says, the founding fathers never believed that tyranny would arise in this country, but if it was going to come here, it would come in the executive branch, in the executive that wanted to push for more power against the Constitution. She believed firmly in the Constitution. So yes, there are parallels, similarities, but you know, she writes a lot about the United States because the United States was her. She became a citizen in 1951, an American citizen. She believed firmly in her republic, as she called it. But she was scared. She was scared about elements of totalitarianism creeping into the government. And, you know, so today, yeah, we're a bit of in a pivot point. And we have to be very careful and we have to learn from history and take any lessons away. You know, the big lesson for Hannah Arendt is she believed in plurality. She said freedom equals plurality, basically. And she believed fervently in civil disobedience, for people to become political and participate in politics. So if there's any lesson to take away from Hannah Arendt is, one, we need to see what's real in front of us with our eyes wide open. Two, we need to become involved politically if we want to protect whatever's dear to us.
Right. The thing about the truth being under attack, that's something she writes about, and objective truth and how there can be the rise of subjective truth, and that may, in a totalitarian regime, we'll talk about that when we come back. So the PBS documentary, it premiered nationwide on June 27th as part of the PBS American Masters series. It did have some encore airings, but it is streaming now. It's available via the PBS.org app, and you can find it online to watch. And so it definitely tells the story of Arendt as a fearless political thinker of the 20th century. And we're going to get into more about her experiences, about what she writes about, explores how, you know, she continued to be a voice for dissent and how important that is in a democracy. And you can call in with your questions and comments. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And you can also email us at thesource@tpr.org. The Source continues after a break. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking with Jeff Bieber. He's the executive producer and co-director of a recently broadcast PBS American Masters program, Hannah Arendt, Facing Tyranny. And our phone lines are open if you've got a question or comment about this brave, fearless writer, political thinker, journalist, and just a person who really, she just lived life. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So, Jeff, it seems like your documentary goes out of your way to really humanize Arendt and tell her story as with her lived history.
Right. You know, as I said a little earlier, she said that all her understanding of the world came from her experience. And what I found was she led a very dramatic life. She was not a perfect individual. She was a bit flawed. I mean, essentially, I found that to pull people into her thinking, her writing, you want to get people involved with her personal story. And I found her personal story to be unbelievably dramatic. You know, just a couple of things. When she goes to start studying in 1924 at the University of Marburg, her mentor is a then Professor Martin Heidegger, who's teaching her how to think. And she ends up having a torrid affair with this guy who's married with two kids. Even though she broke it off a couple of years later to go get a doctorate degree elsewhere, she kept up this relationship with Heidegger to the point where, you know, she truly loved the guy. In 1941-40, when Hitler takes over the Reichstag, Heidegger joins the Nazi party. At that time, she cuts off all ties with him. But 10 years later, she goes back to Germany to collect Jewish artifacts as part of this Jewish Reconstruction Committee and rekindles a relationship with him to help him get his work published. And people ask, why did you do that? How could you do this with this guy who was a Nazi? And the answer given by one of our experts is because she loved the guy. She loved him. And she felt that his work was very important. So there's a lot of controversy around that. And also, when she covers the Eichmann trial, she comes up with this term, the banality of evil. And, you know, we could get into that. But she also gets into real trouble with the Jewish intelligentsia after she kind of blames the Jewish councils for collaborating with Eichmann. And it's very complicated. But she was a woman who didn't hold back. She fervently believed in telling what she saw was the truth. You know, what can I say? She was an amazing character, not without her flaws, but the only way to really make a film work was through an individual's life story.
When she talks about how loneliness is something that creates the fertile ground for totalitarianism to take root, and sorry, I'm coming back to the modern era, but we have been told by the Surgeon General that we have an epidemic of loneliness in the United States. A famous book, Bowling Alone, talks about how people are isolated in their country, and how does that actually happen? How does having a society that's atomized and everyone is scattered, we're not coming together for community events, how does that create totalitarianism?
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, she didn't have this theory of loneliness in the very first edition of Origins of Totalitarianism. She only came about that when she went back to Germany in 1949-1950. And she realized in talking with people and what she observed that there was an ingredient that she called loneliness or existential loneliness that contributed to people longing for meaning in their lives. And you have to see what was happening then, but you could look at what's happening now. You know, now you had After the 2008 market crash, you know, a lot of people went underwater. And during the pandemic, you had people were isolated in their homes. And where are they getting their information from? You know, from the internet, basically. And they're disconnected from their church or their synagogue. They're disconnected from their school or going to work every day. And what she said in Germany was that people were lonely in an existential sense. After World War One, they felt like people, young kids, young people were moving away from, you know, the agrarian society that they had grown up with. They were moving to the cities. That industry was changing very rapidly. People were losing jobs. So they were longing for a life they used to have. And so along comes a strong man, if you will.
Well, that's what he called himself. Hitler said he was the stabilizing leader. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, basically what happens is Arendt writes that along comes an immoral, shameless strong man who harnesses that unrest or that sense of people longing to belong somewhere. And he basically, through propaganda, through that time, the radio, newspaper, lies with slogans and conspiracy theories about the other. And in that case was Jews. And he uses that, he uses propaganda really, really well to create an alternate reality, if you will. You know, a fantasy. So people subscribe to these fantasies in essence to try and hold on to something they believed would get them back to the life they once knew. So loneliness pushes people toward fantasies sometimes when they feel like there's nowhere else to go. And, you know, she also talks about homelessness and rootlessness in an existential sense. You know, you have a huge immigration crisis in Germany after World War One, and that never stops throughout the 20th century. And so people who are living in these places saying, why are these people coming in and taking away our jobs? Who are these people? And so that people's lives are changing. The other thing that happens now with, you know, the huge use of technology, AI is changing everything. And back after World War One, you had huge technological changes and industrial revolution that was really taking root. And so there's a sense of where do I belong? And that's what she means about existential loneliness.
So people are basically free floating. They're not rooted. They're out of their community and they're basically up for grabs for a shiny new, well, a dominant truth. That's also part of what Arendt writes about, that there has to, the movement of a totalitarianism has to have this massive singular truth that everyone has to adhere to, which is, you know, that we're in Germany, we're part of a master race and we're going to make Germany great again, that type of thing.
Yeah, but also she writes about the intellectuals, people like Martin Heidegger, who subscribed to the Nazi Party, because they were rationalizing what was happening in front of them instead of really seeing what was happening in front of them. They were saying, well, you know, he'll never, you know, he's all, it's a lot of talk about, you know, getting rid of the Jews or the Roma, which were gypsies, or any other people who were not part of the Aryan race. A lot of talk. So they were rationalizing things until it got really bad, you know, and, or until some of these people got sent to concentration camps. So she really also said everybody was sucked into this. You know, there's a really good book written about this battalion in Hamburg, I think, in Germany, during World War II, in which this guy documents the soldiers who, before they were drafted, were, you know, part of the community. They were accountants, teachers, whatever. They are drafted into this mobile killing squads, basically, to kill Jews in 1941. And they kill thousands and thousands of men, women, and children. And then they go back to their ordinary lives. And what she talks about in the Eichmann trial, what she discovers, was that ordinary people who were not necessarily, quote unquote, bad people, were sucked into this totalitarian system because they weren't thinking about what they were doing. They were just obeying orders. They were just doing their jobs. They were just basically following what the government told them to do. And that's what she complained about as the banality of evil, that evil can be permeated by many, many people in a system of killing other people. And so that's the danger she saw in the 20th and, you know, in the future, which is the 21st century.
So it just takes people to stand by and do nothing, or just follow their orders and not question, particularly when there is now a new incentive structure that rewards people who do that and punishes people who do stand up and say, I can't do this. This is evil and I'm not going to go along with it. Then you end up the one on the wrong end of the executioner rifle.
Right, that's right. But she also said that what she saw in this new evil were like Eichmann, she said, failed to think about what he was doing. He failed to see the fact that even though he was in charge of transporting people from ghettos to concentration camps to extermination camps, he was basically in charge of transporting people to their deaths. But he said, I was just in charge of transportation. I never killed anybody. So the point is, she also talks about how when bureaucrats, you know, basically are doing their jobs, but it's like pushing the button to kill a lot of people. She said, that's evil. It's like a fungus that grows among us, normal people.
Yeah, the comparison to fungus was really interesting, and how they talked about that in the writings. That mm-hmm. really, and how it spreads, and how once it takes hold, it's very difficult to remove it.
And right.
And so we're going to talk more about, you know, how the impact this sort of this has on democracy, freedom, responsibility. It seems like this is what people can look to in order maybe to counter the rise of totalitarianism. Let's take a break here. Our phone lines are open. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're speaking about Hannah Arendt and about the documentary that aired on PBS recently, but it's available for streaming online. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. With us is Jeff Beaver. He is the executive producer and co-director of a PBS American Masters program documentary that aired recently, Hannah Arendt, Facing Tyranny. If you have a question or a comment, call in 833-877-8255. So how popular is Hannah Arendt these days? Is she still being taught? Or do people still buy her books and read them?
Yeah, it's interesting. She's extremely popular these days. In 2016, when Trump won his first term in office, her book, Origins of Totalitarianism, shot up to the number one list in a lot of different places. People go in and out of favor, I think. But I think there's when you read elements of truths or read things that are, you know, really relevant to what we're doing today, even though it's based in history, you have to ask yourself, where did this come from, right? How did she get these ideas? And how can we apply them to our world today? So yes, she's quoted everywhere. She's very quotable. And if you see her, there are people who are actually making a living out of Hannah Arendt.
Let's go to a caller, Randall. Randall, thanks for calling in. You're on
the
air. Yeah,
me again. Yeah. Hi. Well, when you were talking about ordinary people being rounded up and enlisted to commit these horrific acts that they normally wouldn't do, but they were caught up in this frenzy of authoritarianism and whatever, I was reminded of the Milgram experiment at Yale University in the 1960s. When people were told to deliver electric shocks to this other person that they could not see, it was a person on the other side of the wall. They would ask the person on the other side of the wall questions, and if they got a question wrong, they would deliver an electric shock. And the electric shocks started out very, very low voltage, but they kept, with each wrong answer, the voltage of the shock went up, and it approached, mm-hmm. you know, fatal levels. Mm-hmm. And people
there was
say,
a guy with
hey,
a white coat telling the person to administer the
yes,
shock.
Yes, yes. The experiment must continue. Yes, Yes. So that's what I was reminded of. I just wanted to bring that up. And, okay. You know, if it's just the same kind of thing going on here almost.
Well, Randall, thank you for the call. So it brings up the point, like, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, and there was always a lot of talk about how did Nazi Germany come about? How did Hitler rise? How did this happen? And could it happen in the United States? And we all thought, well, it couldn't, but, you know, now we know better. But, you know, there was a lot of fascination about human nature, but Hannah Arendt writes about human condition, which is different than human nature.
Yeah, I mean, just getting back to that other gentleman's point, the book I was referring to is called Ordinary Men, Reserve Police Battalion 101 and the Final Solution by Christopher Browning. Yeah, I mean, Hannah Arendt writes about the human condition. The Human Condition is one of her biggest books. She writes in 1958. And she writes about kind of three spheres of, you have the private sphere, your own in your home, the public sphere where you're politically active, and the social sphere where, you know, you could form a club and it could be an exclusive club where you don't need people to come. You don't need to admit people to that club. But she basically talked about how in authoritarian regimes, like I was telling before, authoritarian regimes feel the need to take over all of civil society. And you see that happening in Hungary. You see that happening in Venezuela. You see that happening in a lot of different countries. And you're seeing some of that happening here with the push and pull of the Trump administration against universities, against law firms, against the Smithsonian or museums, cultural institutions.
Kennedy Center.
The Kennedy Center, which I know really well. I live in the Maryland, Washington, D.C. area. And, you know, what is it all about, basically? And what it's about is to, put a certain kind of imprint on what is right and what is wrong, right? What's true, what's false, right? What is American history? What's not American history? And, you know, liberal democracies have always thrived on what Arendt talks about, which is plurality, meaning that we need to respect difference. We need to respect one of these words in DEI called diversity. Even with good people and bad people, because that's what makes up a society that's free. But when you become kind of homogenized, when the strong man takes over and dictates what is right, what is wrong, what is true history, what is wrong history, that's when societies start to go downhill. And that's what when we lose our freedom, basically. So she writes about the human experience the last 2,000 years. But ultimately, at the end of the book, she talks about plurality is a key to freedom. And that was very, very important to her. And I think it should be very important to us, too.
Let's go to caller Juan. Juan, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. As a historian, I've read some of the books dealing with concentration camp activity in World War II in Germany. Some of the violence was, the things that were perpetrated were horrendous. You can't imagine a human being doing those things to another human being, but it was very well documented. My concern is in today's society where ICE has, in effect, been given unlimited power to detain anyone, whether you're Hispanic or not. But I mean, you know, like they say in South Park, you know, if you're brown, you're going down. I mean, it's one group, but it's more than one group. And my concern is the fact that the violence is already starting through ICE against U.S. citizens, against immigrants, against whoever it is that they perceive to be, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the perception is of these ICE personnel regarding how they treat individuals. I mean, some of it is right. pretty horrendous. If you've seen some of those items that have come out on TikTok and Facebook and other places.
All right. So Juan, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. So we're seeing these operations happening in the streets. We have these nameless, badgeless, faceless operatives saying they're working with the federal government and they're scooping people off the street and they are being disappeared. Is that a warning sign, Jeff?
Well, you know, Hannah Arendt writes about being a refugee and being a stateless person. You know, in 1935, Germany passes the Nuremberg Laws that essentially where all German Jews are no longer German citizens. So for 18 years, Hannah Arendt and many other thousands of other people did not have citizenship. And what she found was stateless people are dependent on the state to provide rights. And without being a member of the state, they have no rights. So the apprehension of students from other countries without due process, the disappearing to out-of-state prisons or to other countries or to vans. It's very familiar. It's, you know, after the Reichstag fire, and again, I want to be very careful that we're kind of comparing history of what happened in one place to what's happening now. People do have due process. That's the big, big, I mean, in the sense that people have been arrested without being read their rights or anything like that. But you've seen people who have been arrested and held for quite a long time who have ultimately gone to trial and the courts have sided with people to get released, like that guy, first guy from Columbia University. So there still is a system of due process here. But yeah, she writes about the status of people without rights who are not a member or quote unquote member of the state. And during the McCarthy period, her husband had been an ex-communist. And she was very worried that her husband and others would lose their citizenship.
And they were denaturalizing people as well. Yeah, during that time.
Well, there was talk of denaturalizing people. I'm not sure they ever did that. But the point is the threat was there. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing threats here that we've never seen before.
Well, let me ask you really quickly, because I got about a minute and a half here. What does she say about how long a totalitarianism regime can exist? She says they don't have a very long lifespan.
Well, I think Germany, Nazi Germany, existed for about 12 years because they keep wanting to expand their power base. They keep wanting to expand and expand. But ultimately, they die like a star. They implode.
And they put a lot of incompetent people in positions of power and authority.
Well, yeah. I mean, she came up with this great
phrase. We're seeing that here, too.
They put fools and crackpots in power because of their loyalty to the leader, basically.
So, I mean, looking for the little grain of hope here is that these totalitarian regimes tend to burn out.
Well, they burn out, but the big hope, the big sliver of hope here is that she believed in a civil disobedience, and she believed in plurality and beginning anew. She believed that people have the power for change, but they have to put it to use. They have to become politically active, and we've seen that time and time again here in this country during the 60s and early 70s, and we've seen it in other countries. So. You know, we're still a democracy, but we have to fight to keep it.
Jeff Bieber, great words. Appreciate you coming on board today and talking to us. He was the executive producer, co-director of Hannah Arendt's Facing Tyranny. You can view it online at the pbs.org and on their app. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Kim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.